Welcome everyone to our last episode for our late to the party rewatch of Neon Genesis Evangelion, the seminal teenagers versus their feelings anime of the late 20th century. I'm Frank, and together with Russell, Al, James, and Michelle, we're walking you through the show as it finally receives wide distribution on Netflix. We apologize. We apologize for every listener we lured into watching that. No, that's extreme. So This is it. We wrapped up the actual series in our last episode.
Yep.
And now we're going to be talking about some of the ancillary stuff that has come out after this. We're going to talk about the whole series, but we're going to talk about End and Birth and Rebirth. Right? End of
Death and Rebirth.
Death and Rebirth. And End of Evangelion. So everything is, it's all in. Although
it's all on the table.
Even that isn't really fair because there's like a bunch of manga we're not talking about. And there's like
re-release movies.
Rebuilds we're not actually talking about. But okay, Russell, as the person probably most to blame for this, give us a little bit of the history of where we're at right now and what's going on.
Death and Rebirth is largely a clip show of the entire series, kind of combining everything. Honestly, I think the real reason that was made was to get a little more money in the coffers so that they could continue, you know, milking the cow, so to speak, of Evangelion for a little while. And that led up to creating the End of Evangelion, which was a theatrical release structured as if it were two episodes of the show that are meant to stand in as replacements for episode 25 and 26. So this covers the entirety of the Human Instrumentality Project that in the TV series release was largely done through an interview with Shinji and a lot of weird flashbacks and a lot of strange art choices.
Yeah, all right. So basically, at this point, if you're watching this show along with us, and hopefully you are not just listening to us fall apart and having never seen the show, that would be interesting. Interesting choice. But if you're watching along, there are really, I feel like I'm couching everything with ifs and thens and buts.
You are,
but
it's okay.
There are two real endings for Evangelion, the original Evangelion. There's the one we have already discussed, which we'll talk a little bit more about this week now that James is with us. And Shinji starts to realize, or not even realize, just it starts to examine his inner monologue, his psyche, and what his motivations are for getting into the robot. And we pretty much lose the narrative thread of the series entirely as we goes right into Shinji's psychosis or his mental state. Then there's this version done a few years later, which is, I guess people are referring to it as a replacement, and I could see that, but I've also heard people refer to it as an answer to the people who dared complain that the original series ended too esoteric, and
I believe that's still argued a good deal. There is, you know, some evidence that actually they had hoped to do something a little more like this movie when they ended the series, but ran out of money, and you know, so it's still up for debate as to which is the true ending.
I was going to say, I've even heard some debate say that they didn't run out of money to finish the show and that the ending of the show is intentional. I don't know how, you know, the 26 episodes, I don't know how true that is. I'm actually someone who, particularly this time around, after watching this entire experience, I think I like the last two episodes of the show the best.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with that too.
All of the
Of all the endings?
All of the stuff I've seen so far up until this point, it's a little nuts, but I like the sort of nuts it is. I like the style of it. I like all of the weird creative choices they're making, like ripping up the frames of paper and like retaping them back together for Misato and the line drawings and the reused clips. And there's just something about it that feels just wholly original in its insanity. And I don't have a problem with its esoteric BS and nonsense here.
Except that you're although just calling it, is. It BS and nonsense, but all right.
It absolutely is. It absolutely is, but I feel like it wholly owns it here. It's not, we're not trying to be an anime anymore. We're not trying to be, you know, like, it is wholly, these two episodes are wholly its own thing. Its own creation has created this own sort of little bubble that is this two-episode time period in which it exists that I don't think anybody's ever really been able to repeat because it's just such nonsense.
Mm. Interesting. Al, what were you going to say?
I think that's it certainly ends on a much more positive note than the film does as far as when you think about the series.
Okay, yeah.
The congratulations, so, I mean, that's...
all right. Congratulations, that you learned to love yourself.
More positive, yeah.
Yeah, there's certainly... Certainly better things happen in that than what happened.
I'll give you this. It's more up for interpretation, I think. Yes. I think in many ways.
Yeah.
All right. And I enjoy that because that's something I've enjoyed about the series as we've rewatched it.
Russell, do you disagree with it being a more positive note?
I'm going to be kind of the dissenting voice here. I actually prefer End of Evangelion as the closure of things. It might partially be because of how much I enjoy Akira. So the idea of everything ending with an apocalypse just kind of, you know,
makes sense. Feels right.
Yeah. But I mean, we see a lot of interesting turns because this was away from television. They, you know, characters have nipples now. They amp up the violence in some scenes. They amp up the sexuality. We have a lot of discussion of Shinji, you know. Yeah, a lot of it comes around to, oh, has this been about Shinji's sexuality the whole time? Has this been about his, you know, his sexual maturity? Is that what this is? You know, not necessarily, but we have a lot more dialogue and actions focused on that.
Michelle, as somebody who's just recently seen this or for the first time, what do you think
this has all been about?
Someone describe my face.
It's
dull surprise.
There's an affect
shock.
There's sort of an affect disorder.
I feel like Asuka in the bathtub.
Oh
yeah,
wow.
That's
oh god, I apologize.
Woof. Yeah.
I literally cannot even keep straight which ending with which.
It's very easy to blend them together.
And
yeah.
I am totally not looking at episode descriptions on my phone right now to try and come up with an answer for you.
Yeah. So here's my take on this, and I'm hopefully not doing the thing that everybody involved in owning a piece of this series has done for the last 20 years, which is remixing and remastering and modifying. But I feel like there is a way of mixing all these together that makes sense. So the unsatisfying thing for the original ending where, you know, Shinji is dealing with crisis after crisis until eventually he collapses in the last two episodes and he examines what his worth is and what his role in the world is, what his purpose is. And we've talked in the last episode about it being an examination of an artist who has an incredible amount of pressure behind them, suddenly finding that they're at the head of a ship piloting this gigantic mech of an animated series and deciding why am I doing this? And I think in that respect, that part of the show is really interesting.
Mm.
I could see where there's disappointment, though, in that it feels like we go from yet another struggle, Shinji. In this one, it's who's the fifth child? What's his name again?
Karu.
Again, everyone making it as if this character was super important, but literally shows up in an episode. Shinji gets attached, dies, and then Shinji collapses for two episodes. And I think that's where the disappointment goes. Not that Kairu isn't important to Shinji, but that there isn't more going on afterwards. What I like from End of Evangelion, Asuka gets a form of an arc in that, right? She eventually pulls herself out and kicks ass. Mm. It doesn't necessarily help. But that feels narratively cohesive. Not just, I fell apart because I didn't do well once. Maybe this is all in my head because I failed for the first time and I'm not used to failing. And then I'm just written out of the story, which happens in the original series. They give her something in End of Evangelion where you feel like, okay, I get how you've fallen apart on that. I think so. If you take it from Shinji experiences yet another trauma with this guy he likes who he has to kill, and then all the things that happen in End of Evangelion as Nerve collapses upon itself, and then wrap it up with those last few episodes, I think there's a little bit more, there's a narrative arc there that feels a little bit more complete.
Also, let's give credit to Asuka for being, like, I think one of the very few characters actually figure out what the Evas are.
Yes, I guess. Did she? Well, I don't even
Yeah, like,
that.
Before anyone else gets it, Asuka's like, oh, Mom's here! Like, and, like, finally understands what the Evas have been this entire time.
Oh.
Elaborate.
Huh?
I elaborate.
Oh, that her mother is the Eva?
Asuka's mother's the Eva?
Well, that's what they've always been. They've been the moms the whole time.
What's going on?
Like, there's literally Asuka's like, I can't lose, not with Mama behind me. And like, it's like,
I'm sorry. Oh. James and I were both picturing the Eva she was fighting.
Yes,
No.
Yeah, I think Asuka's saying that her mom has been there to protect her. I don't think it's literally the Eva.
Oh, no, it is.
I mean, in Shinji's case, yeah, the dummy plugs, the mines that they built the Evas from, aren't they all Rey? From Adam, which is technically Rey, which Rey is a conjoined sort of clone of Yui, who is Shinji's mother?
I'm not going to unravel this knot.
Okay. But no, that's okay, usually...
So okay, Russell.
Go ahead, Russell.
All right, yeah. So it's all derived...
Michelle still looks confused.
from, you know, it's all derived from the effects of people at Second Impact and the follow-up to that. So, the idea is that Rey is being cloned repeatedly from Yui's, biological material, but that the Evas as well are clones. They are humanoid. We kind of touch on that before we get into End of Evangelion, how, you know, when they look at the genetic code of the Evas, it's human. You know, they are gigantic mutated humanoids, you know, wrapped in armor. And that's kind of, the idea is the AT field is... I think I touched on this before. The AT field is the thing that forms a barrier between beings. And a lot of the instrumentality project, as we get to in End of Evangelion, is about the breaking down of those barriers, those separations between people. And is that necessary or good or whatever? And the idea being that pilots of Evangelions are being protected by their mothers while they are sort of, you know, riding inside the womb of their mothers, and their mother's protectiveness is creating a strong enough AT field to keep the Eva safe from all of these other dangers out there.
Yeah, that's kind of my reading of it as well. Not that the Evas were literally cloned from their mother's bodies.
Yeah, even Asuka's mom was involved in like the Eva project, and like part of like the reason why she winds up snapping is because of some stuff that she's been doing with the Eva, and like it's. One way to take it is that, like, part of her is just now in the Eva, and, like, that would, you know...
That's certainly a darker interpretation that I did not see, that literally some of her mother was used as the clone. And it also would make sense why certain children, I guess, are picked, although, who knows, some of the kids that were picked in this process seem random. I feel like you could... there's a lot of Rorschach tests to Evangelion where you could project a lot on what you're seeing. And I think that's great. That's fine. I think these additional potential readings are awesome to me. What I think is most troubling with fans, and it's interesting because we just this last weekend, give you a little bit of how the sausage is made. Some of us were at a party and we're talking about this podcast. And a few people who have been longtime Evangelion fans were like talking to us very excitedly. And it sounded weird. It just felt like they were talking about a different show. And I discovered that they had not finished watching it. Years ago, they started watching it. They had not gotten to the last episode. I'm like, well, let's talk. And then I said the phrase that has been said to me 1,000 times. It's talk to me after you finish the series. And I'm part of the problem now. No. I think that there's good and bad in both versions of the ending.
Yeah.
Well, I think one of the big differences between the two endings is we talked about how, 25 and 26 is very much Shinji's personal analysis of his place in the world, of his existence in the world. Whereas with End of Evangelion, it's everyone's place in the world. It becomes an apocalypse. It becomes a worldwide thing. The third impact is now about all of humanity being sort of caught up in this big question: is life worth living? Does the pain of life make life untenable? And that's kind of the question that Shinji is forced to answer through Rei's decision to attach to him instead of Gendo. You know, she rejects Gendo. She decides Shinji is, who she wants to have guide the instrumentality. And then, that's kind of what that's kind of what inspires us to this ending, where it's, you know, he has to decide, is it worth it to live life as individuals, or are we better as a sort of faceless collective?
I just, yes, that's totally the reading of this that I got. But Shinji, I guess, decides life is worth living, but like for himself, I don't know. I thought
we've had a sort of a preview of this, honestly, in which episode was it? Shape of Heart, Shape of Human, episode 20, where Shinji melts inside his entry plug and then reforms and is born again.
Yeah.
We're honestly seeing that same thing happen. It's just worldwide scale. Everybody is melting into the LCL.
But I mean, he chooses...
And then there's the question of, you know, of should you be reborn from that?
But he chooses only to rebirth himself and Asuka, right? And when he comes back, he's either still angry at her or still having such post-traumatic stress about everything that just happened that he's just mindlessly reacting.
All right, I think we really need to dial this back because we're too broad. I think we need to take this from where it starts, unfortunately, and we need to move through this movie a little bit.
I made a note to myself to give people a content warning, which is going to be way late to the game, because I did not know that this movie, End of Evangelion, starts with a sexual assault. It does.
It does.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what? And I actually had to look it up. I was like, what am I watching? And I looked it up, and I was like, all right, that's what I kind of thought was happening.
Yeah, Shinji with a handful of baby batter.
That's not how I would say that.
No. All right.
That's how they say it on a commentary track, actually.
Yep, I love that line. Track,
the DVD, that's there.
Oh, all right. Well, that's how
Amanda Windley refers to it. But.
Well, that's at least relevant now. Again, same thing with you. It's certainly something I didn't pick up on when I watched it, you know.
As a kid.
And for, I think, for a series... Well isn't the term I want to use here, because I don't think it ever handles that sexuality that they're exploring with Shinji perfectly. But I don't know. It just never commits to it like that until we get there.
There's a lot of strange commitments in Evangelion to the sexuality. That's part of what I'm a little upset about, is it feels like at some point, this is me, and I know, now I finally know why Evangelion fans do this, because I'm doing it. I'm trying to remix the show that makes more sense. I'm trying to give context to where things kind of fall apart. It's hard not to. So in my version of it, it's like they had a version of the show that if they had enough money, they would put a little bit more world destruction and, you know, Rey becoming a Lilith. And it ends with travesty and destruction and Third Impact, and then a couple of episodes of Shinji looking into himself and seeing does it all matter, and then it wraps up. And in that version, if it was that perfectly realized version, that all might track wonderfully. But because it's done piecemeal and we've only gotten over pieces over the years, and one version seems like it's a little angry, it feels like all those failures are kind of like I said, it feels a little angry. So Masato hitting like offering herself to Shinji feels like something they could have been building towards at some point, but it really just felt tacked on. They were like, okay, let's put some.
It particularly feels tacked on because like clearly she knows she's going to die, yeah. Right? Like what is some sort of motivation? As if Shinji's only motivation for doing any of this was always sex?
We never established it. And like maybe this was like a Hail Mary, but like it's a little late in the series. And there's not a lot of context in that moment for us to know what the intent of the characters are. So we start thinking about what the intent of the artist is. And that's why all this hypothetical, like, oh, it's an anger ending.
It's pretty angry, though.
Yeah. And to that effect, I can say the end of Evangelion is as if nothing beautiful. It is physically beautiful. The animation in the end of Evangelion, I think, is superb.
Oh, it's, God, yes, absolutely.
It's just so beautiful. It's grandiose on a level that is almost unusual for the series, right? You know, I'm watching the wings sprout out of the other Evas and Shinji's Eva being pinned up like a cross. And I, you know, and I'm thinking like Gundam Wing. I'm thinking like, you know, like some of these really grandiose, really, you know, like just crazy imagery sort of stuff that just looks amazing and just has just such this visual power to it. And that's all I got.
Yeah, I'm with James on this. Like, I've watched this movie, I think, maybe 20 times in my life. Because at one point, again, I will say I was a huge fan of this series. I loved this film. I think there was a time I didn't go a week without watching it.
Like, oh, wow.
Like,
wow.
That's how much I used to really love this series and this film in particular. And I'm very familiar. I'm intimately familiar with it at this point. And it's just like, if there's one thing it's got the visuals. That's definitely something. But
so
it does
what's
not...
soured for you? You seem to have flipped on that, though. I'm not quite saying I'm soured. I'm just saying that I could see where the flaws pop up in people's appreciation with this. I'm curious about what soured with you.
I stopped being an edgelord teenager. That's kind of, I think that's what soured.
Oh, that's not fair. Oh, that's not fair. All right, Michelle, what did you think? How did I know that it's overwhelming, but is there anything out of this do you feel like, oh, it's so close if they had only given me more of this? Or is it completely out of
I'm like in a whole other world.
Is there
really
anything
I think everything made sense to me until episode about like 22. I was good. And then when they started like I get the artist is trying to show something about humanity and the are we better as a unit or should we accept our individuality and go for what we want in life? But I don't know what I would have done if I watched this when I was like 9, like a lot of other people did.
Yeah, no, this is like,
I definitely wasn't 9.
You did not, if you did not expect this.
Okay.
You are...
Well, you weren't. I know some people who watched it when they were like kids.
Yeah. I mean, like, this feels
they're
like
messed up now.
This is a teenager.
Yes, they are.
A giant a robot thing. I mean, I could definitely see why someone would.
So I did like the graphics were nice, like the animation of everything.
It's beautiful.
The end was nice. And I was slowly starting to see there when the Eva's in the sky and has the whole cross thing going on.
Yeah.
And then it kept cutting back to the music rehearsal and you could see, or am I jumping ahead? Am I in the other movie now?
No, go. Keep going.
I don't know. But there was, you could see on the stage, there was the stage markers, which were in the same cross pattern.
Oh, very nice. Yeah. Yeah. It was,
so, there is a lot of,
yeah,
symbolism and
the
they threw
that
a
make
lot
you
of
think.
Symbolism there.
I had to think about a lot of things in a very short amount of time because I binge watched this last night / this morning / my lunch break / right now.
Oh. That's not a great mix.
what it?
It's like I ate too much pie.
Yeah.
Do we have any feelings about the? So there's the small bit in the end of Evangelion that's of the live action street, right?
Yeah, we have the three women in cosplay.
And the three women in cosplay. And I just, you know, when you're returning
it
back
was there.
To, when you're returning
I believe you.
Back to, it feels angry, Frank. I mean, that shot feels almost the angriest of all.
No, the angriest shot. No, I think there's a couple of them really towards the end that are the most angry. One is just all the death threats just speed running past the frame. That's
right.
Where it got really angry. And then there's the like panning shot of the audience and like, how does it feel?
Interesting.
I'm like, all right, Anno, I get it.
I, at this point, I was a little bit like, I was overwhelmed by the symbolism. So I did start tuning out a little bit at this point.
See, that's an interesting sequence as well, though, because we're listening to Bach. We're listening to some of the most beautiful, comforting music ever written. I mean, that. What is that? Is that Sheeple Safely Graze? I can't remember exactly. But it's, you know, it's a piece that is always used when they need to imply a pastoral mood. And we're seeing images of trains and light poles and telephone wires. And so it's all of these things that are very industrial and sort of crude and utilitarian. But we're putting this beautiful music against it in order to start off that sequence. And I always thought that was very interesting, that here we are trying to take the works of people, those, you know, necessary utilitarian constructions, And we're trying to actually show some beauty in them with this, you know, with this juxtaposition, because it's not done in a ironic or thoughtless way.
Oh yeah, this isn't a random bunch of B-roll with a random soundtrack. All of this is intentional, including the death threats, right? So we'll go back to the death threats in a bit. But in terms of the series has things to say about how humanity is and how we work with our tools, specifically technology, right? And it's, I don't know what it is, where it comes, maybe it doesn't come down anywhere hard, because it seems like we need it. It's what defines us. Our technology, our advancements define us, but also alienate us, make us less human.
To survive.
And it's sort of unsettling because there isn't really an answer to it. And where you think the answer might come up in the symbolism of everything that's going on, the truth of the matter is a lot of that symbolism, a lot of the religious iconography is, that's frosting.
That's exactly the
giant robots. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily the point, right? It's just like giant robots. So when we talk about science fiction, if you're ever learning about science fiction in a collegiate setting, they're talking about, well, it's not really about the giant robots or the aliens. It's what those things represent in our real world. And for this series, it's not just about the giant robots or the crucifixions that happen like a lot in it. Those are just, that's just the window dressing. It's really about people trying to come to terms with their own role in the world. But I can't stop thinking about those death threats and the fact that they are factored into this. That's intentional, right? And I don't think they're talking about like, oh, look at this, the world where you could just send a letter to someone saying you hate them. I think part of this is a pushback against the way the show was originally absorbed. And I just think you can't get more obvious than including those.
Well, it's a perfect way to drive home what's happening in the story. The division of Shinji with everyone else. Why can't people be nice to me? Why can't I understand other people? And there you are. Somebody out in the real world has given Anno the perfect material in order to emphasize that, in order to exemplify that.
And I think the entire film is really like this weird Faustian bargain where everyone got what they wanted. And I like, this is again taking more stuff from the commentary track. Where they even talk about how like you got everything you wanted, but it was at such a terrible price. Like you get Asuka kicking butt again, but wow, does that turn out pretty bad for her? You get like the forefront of all these things that just, you know, you really wanted answers to, but like they just raise more questions.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like there's so many things in here that just feel so designed specifically to annoy the audience. And I can, one of them in particular drives me up a freaking wall. Is the moment when Ritsuko goes to like betray Gendo and fails, and then Gendo's just like, well, the truth is, and then he just, you know, cuts out, and it's like,
yeah, we don't get to hear what he says.
And it's like, it's for no other reason than just to spite the audience.
Yeah, these are the things. So let's assume an audience with good faith, somebody who wants to watch the show. If you want to watch the show and want to see what the artist is intending in this point, you have to contend against a decent amount of white noise that's just sort of like chuckling to yourself saying, haha, I don't like this, and I'm going to throw this in your face. Things where Gendo's almost going to finish a line, but he doesn't. The Shinji pleasuring himself over the unconscious body of a character that's off considered cheesecake in the series in the first place. And then even arguably the ending of them fighting with each other on the beach, the blood red.
Which is so weird.
And at all those points, because you're never quite certain how much of this is as intended and how much of this is a little like inflamed because of bad feelings at the time, it makes it very frustrating. So much so, in fact, that despite the fact that I'm currently like writing fanfic, trying to piece all these things together, I refuse to watch Rebuild. I'm not going to watch Rebuild until it's all done. Somebody else has watched it and tells me it actually does wrap things up pretty well. And I know they've gone well off script by now.
Oh, wow.
But it doesn't matter to me. Because if the last Rebuild movie is, again, them on an asteroid talking about, like, Thor and how, you know...
it's all about Norse gods the whole time.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm good. I got this. I almost wish nobody sent you angry letters the first time. We never got the Evangelion. But I think there's good in both, and you can mix it up in a way that almost feels satisfying.
Yeah.
It's funny because two things. One, I think if Evangelion, the series, you know, Al said to my art point a while back, you know, I think that's total BS. You know, it's a great point. But if Evangelion wasn't about art, the end of Evangelion sure as heck is.
Oh, it's, yeah, I'll give you that 100%. It's definitely about art in its own way.
So, you know, that can really help reframe the series, I think, in my narrative. So, you know, go for that. No, but you know, in that sort of way, which I think is great. But I think I kind of walked out the opposite of you. I'm almost interested in turning to the rebuilds now because of just such a, I don't know what, like, I guess I'm curious walking away from this. What is the legacy of this show? It is so kind of important in the anime community for reasons that sometimes almost seem unfounded, right? Like it's
I agree with that.
It's like, there's a lot of thing, you know, to go back to somebody like Karu. Karu has obviously become a very important character for a lot of reasons, whether that's because of the representation of LGBT within the Evangelion series. But again, it's something like that you mentioned, a character that's prior to the end of Evangelion has a minute amount of screen time, right? It's a character that we've built up, right? And I think Evangelion is exactly that. Right. It's a series we've built up. Right. We've built up this mythology. We've built up this importance to it, which, I mean, I guess is, I think, kind of how all important works of art go. But our interpretation of it is more important and more meaningful than the actual art, because people just write off what they don't like. You know, nobody's coming back and telling, I mean, I'm sure that somebody is, but, you know, people aren't coming back and saying, well, let's examine, you know, the fact that Shinji is a complete sexual assaulter at the beginning of, you know, the end of Evangelion. We're talking about, you know, these other minute things that we want to see inside it, and we ignore the pieces that don't fit to the narrative we want. And that's how art is interpreted, and that's why Evangelion is important, because it's a show that I think beyond that does that so inherently, giving you something to interpret, right?
It's the Rorschach test of giant anime, teenagers fighting giant
there's
monsters.
No, you know, and it's the same thing with something like Watchmen, right? There's, you know, when we walk away from My Hero Academia or Sailor Moon or Pokemon, nobody, you know, our fun think pieces on that are only fun. They're like laughing jokes that Ash is really dead in a coma or something, right? But
yes.
But the end of Evangelion is so important because it is this infinitely interpretable work as compared to straight classic narratives.
Yeah, this is what it is.
And that's its legacy. I don't even think it matters if it's good or not. Right?
Ooh, like,
and it's not.
Interesting.
Which
no. Russell, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it is the Watchmen. I think we've made the Watchmen comparison before, and I think that is true. It is what it is, because it partially was considered a deconstruction of the genre. And we've talked about how it engages with some tropes and disengages with others, which is why I think it's interesting that when we look at the end of the TV series, it is very much its own thing. But then when we do have the end of Evangelion film, I was drawing the parallels to Akira. So it's an apocalyptic event that sort of reshapes everyone's perception of the world. You know, in the case of Akira, it's more about the idea of, you know, this end of humanity and humanity needing to recognize its evolution. And again, in Evangelion, we're costuming it as the evolution. You know, humanity abandons individual AT fields, merges together into one collective entity like the other angels, because the angels are all independent organisms. And, you know, and then there's sort of that question of, well, is that better or worse? You know, then we break into the idea there of you know, deciding things for yourself, individuality, personal existence. But again, we are kind of going from that same ground of let's have an apocalypse in order to make these decisions. And then you can draw all kinds of allusions to all sorts of things like, you know, everyone talks about in Akira. There's a lot of discussion about, the use of atomic weapons, the major shifts in the world of politics and huge destructive events in people's lives. So, you know, we're tying together a whole lot of stuff in here. And that's where we get into this idea that everyone wants to interpret what they can, because it is packed full of symbolism, packed full of this stuff. We've talked about how, like, you know, okay, the religious trappings and all that stuff, that is just there for the look of it. But I mean, they still refer to it as all these kind of ritualistic things that are being done to conjure up this supernatural ending of humanity. So, you know, they've emptied out the suitcase full of ideas here. And that's what makes it easy for people to root through and pick what they want.
Yeah, I think I think both of you hit it. Like, that is pretty accurate. There is, there's a certain mirror to this art that we just see what we want to see in it. So I don't even know if this is going to make it into the podcast. I'd like just to try one thing. Early on in this series, this podcast, we said that we were interested in looking at Evangelion now in light of the, in many respects, pending global climate crisis, right? Because there's a concept of the second impact, you know, having a major effect on the world, and that it may happen, there may even get worse. So just using that one filter, which isn't even everyone's favorite filter, it's just something we established in earlier recordings as something we thought the series was about. Now that it's over, what do we think? I'm just curious to see if this, I keep using it, Rorschach test of a series, can flex for something that is sort of arbitrarily decided, like the global climate crisis.
I guess so. Let's interpret then the impacts, right? So, you know, we think of, let's say, second impact is something that we think of an event that happened to the Earth, right? You've got a whole bunch of people talking about climate change and talking about stuff like, well, the Earth, you know, it just does this. It goes through these cycles.
It's being put forward as if this happened to us.
Correct.
Right?
But clearly, when we go back and dissect that, when we see the history of second impact, it's not. It's something we caused.
Right.
We were experimenting. We were trying new things. We were doing stuff that eventually caused this disaster. Right. So instead, there were a lot of people who formed an organization in which to try and stop this disaster, but at the same, the next disaster, right?
But
the
even
third
then,
impact. But even then, there are still people who either didn't believe it was going to happen or felt like, maybe it's better. Maybe humanity has run out its time, right?
And then I'd even go forward and say that in third impact, as written in the series, was the people who had the power to stop it thought it was inevitable
and
pushed it forward because of some personal gain.
Exactly,
there was a decision among sort of the powerful that this was a thing that was inevitable and was something that they should bring about because they thought they would be in control of it if they were the ones to bring it about. You know, Gendo is constructing Rei and the Eva in order to be, you know, the guiding hand of human instrumentality of third impact.
When we talk about the whole power dynamic of it all, we see it, I feel like we see it now with the whole climate change dilemma, in which there are things we can definitely do to prevent any further damage from happening. But because of, I think I saw something the other day where it's like, me not recycling my water bottle one day isn't what is ruining the Earth. It's the 1% of powerful businesses that are dumping toxic
100%. And also
things into, and I feel like you see the same thing where it's like, there are people in Evangelion that definitely could prevent something bad from happening, but they're,
it's
like,
not about a little kid punching back the aliens.
Yeah.
It's about them stopping it from exasperating it.
And it's not that they don't care. It's just that they feel like at the end of the day, they're going to be the people who are in control of that situation.
Yeah.
They think that they have some control, but it's all a lie.
It's a lot of ignorance.
I'm going to pull this back in, and maybe I could do some citations in this podcast, but I've heard increasing, and maybe this is just panic, what have you, but I've heard increasing rumbles that there are people who are, and actually you could see this in reality. There's no question that this exists to some degree. There are people who have the means to do something about the world as it is, that seem more preoccupied in protecting themselves mm-hmm. from the fallout of that world. I'll try to find the actual article, but one futurist has gone on record saying he was invited over to like a think tank of billionaires who have basically started asking him questions left and right. And it was very obvious they were asking questions about whether minds can be uploaded to the internet, which is a thing that a billionaire is attempting right now, whether... which environments would be the safest to move to after the climate collapse? How do you ensure loyalty in your guards if there isn't money to pay them with? And things like cryptocurrency and how we could protect that. So literally people who have power see the world coming to an end, instead of saying, let's do something about this, are saying, how do we protect ourselves? How do we make ourselves on top afterwards? That seems like it's, you know, tinfoil hat craziness, but like we kind of do see that in terms of education, where mm-hmm. people would rather than, you know, foster a failing education, public education across the country or across the world or whatever, will instead make sure their offspring go to private schools and will do whatever they can to defund one to power the other. That this is all reality, and I think you can see this in the show. I'm not going to say that Anna was writing about that in this. I'm saying that might be one of the powerful things about the show, is that there is a little bit of a choose-your-own-adventure how it goes down.
So I think we're saying that with its re-release on Netflix, it's still could possibly remain relevant, even all this time later, because of its... out there adaptableness, as you said, the Rorschach test.
It goes back to that legacy thing we were talking about. Like, there's plenty of things that show up and, like, are always going to be relevant. Like, there's plenty of things that, like, the almighty Star Wars brought up, like, back in the 70s. That's, like, aren't, like, they were hard-hitting issues for Lucas at the time that still ring true now. So mm-hmm. it's just, you know.
Mm-hmm. Right now, the world of video games is battling for the soul of Final Fantasy VII. Because that game, in its original release, had a very strong message about the environment. It starts with a group of terrorists attacking a power plant in order to stop pollution by a gigantic megacorporation. And that's a lot of people were wondering, is that, they're about to remake that game. Are they going to continue with that message? Or is it going to be watered down into Cloud and Sephiroth sure do hate each other, and that'll be Ooh. The totality of it. These things, there's relevance in these ideas from media that's 20 years old, and that's the thing. 20 years ago, we still haven't dealt with these problems that all this media was laying out in front of us 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And I think what is most interesting about the end of this series and all the various ways it falls to pieces and works is that there's still that desire to make it fit slightly better. And I think now more than ever, especially now that they've announced a date for the latest rebuild, right? It's going to come out in 2020, that we are getting closer to some sort of modification of the allegedly pristine version of what it could have been, which I don't necessarily think is the point. I really don't think it is the point to find a version of this series that is the most accurate, most canonical.
As weird as it sounds, if I could touch on Rebuild for a hot second from the bits from what I've watched, man, that thing loses the narrative in a very different way.
Interesting.
Yeah. And I almost feel like I kind of like the way this one lost the narrative more than Rebuild lost it.
I don't know what you're talking about, but I can definitely understand it now that I've seen End of Evangelion. And I'm like, bits and pieces.
Funnily enough, there is a piece in Rebuild where they talk more specifically about the efforts of humanity to turn back the environmental effects of Second Impact. They really focus in on that for a good 10 minutes.
Do we want to talk at all about some of the differences between the Netflix, and have we ever really dove into that?
Yeah, let's go through it quickly and we'll wrap this up on that subject matter. obviously a lot of you have watched this for the first time on Netflix or are rewatching it for the first time on Netflix, and there are some changes that we really need to get into. Michelle?
I watched probably most of the original episodes not on Netflix, the original ones, and then watched a couple of the last ones on Netflix. When they switched the language over from first child to first children, I'm sorry. Yeah, I think we did, but it even drove me it drove me nuts even more during like the movies, I think.
Yeah.
Because they just said it a lot more, and then with the when they brought in the fifth child, the fifth children. Oh, he is the fifth children. I just in my head I scream.
I think it was a bad choice is what we've decided.
I don't understand why.
It's something about the way the Japanese language works with pluralization and but how one was more accurate, but not necessarily good.
There's this thing about translation in which nothing is ever perfect.
I think it's, and it's probably going to come back to a lot of the comments we have here, but localization is very important, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's about understanding not just where your material is coming from, who is going to be interpreting your material.
Yeah.
For me, I think it was just the removing of the cursing, right? So in the Japanese language, as far as I've gone to understand it, they don't really have like curse words. They have different emphasis they put on existing words to make them more or less powerful.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's almost as if like, it feels as if this series decided like it wasn't going to do cursing because it would somehow make it more accessible. But I mean, like at no point does this series become more accessible because they're not saying, you know, I know we try not to, but shit or fuck all the time.
Right.
Like, and some of the stuff just doesn't work. The opening of End, I am the lowest of the low. I really just don't think that cuts it. That scene is probably one of the most horrifying scenes in all of Eva, particularly, you know, coming back at it from the world we live in now and just the reality of it. And the original line says it right. I'm so fucked up.
Yeah.
Because it does get across like exactly how, like how you should feel about him. And like, yeah, it's weird.
And how he feels about himself. Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. You know what? I don't know the appeal of a character whose name I forgot again.
Kaoru.
I don't really know the appeal, but now that I have to acknowledge it exists, and actually, I think that part of the appeal is starvation, right? And you don't have representation for so long, even a glimmer of one character in half an episode.
Who's very charming.
Right.
And he has nice hair.
The fact that he exists, that there is that moment, it is important for people, and you take away love and replace it with like. I think, as I said before in an earlier episode, love and like, I think both have useful terms of the vagueness of what he's saying, but, you know, you did take it back. It was love for a while, and you dialed it back to like, so that means something.
Amusingly enough, when we get to End of Evangelion, I watched the Netflix version of End of Evangelion. When we get to that, there is a flash where Rei appears as Kaoru to Shinji.
Have you been here the whole time?
In the ending. Yeah, and they use the word love in that scene. So, you know, it comes back when it's the movie version.
Yeah, it's again, I'll go back to that localization thing. Understanding the audience, right? So had you understood the audience that had been watching this show, you would know the importance of Kaoru to the people who watched it.
Yeah.
Right? To a group of people who identified with this character, and you would know, probably not something we should fuck with.
I really, at the end of the day, genuinely feel like this translation, like, we were saying this earlier about how, like, it didn't seem to care about its audience. Like, in a certain extent, I almost feel like this is appropriate. Well, you got Anno. You did. Or at the time, you got him. He didn't care about his audience either. So, proper translation.
You got it more than the rest of us.
But no, in reality, I feel like this is like some internet troll from in the 90s who finally got the job to translate the script and was just so happy about it.
I'm going to be a little bit more fair because I think there's a lot of anger that comes up for this series, especially for Mal. But I do think that there, when you get the job to do the translation, you want to bring something original to it and you want to try. And there is good reason to make those translation changes that they did, but there was also some mistakes, and I think that's probably what we really experienced. It's just like,
yeah.
take the good, you take the bad.
It's just so weird because it's every argument that everyone ever made on the internet about the original Ava dub about how, like, why don't they call them children? Like, because it wouldn't sound right. Why would you call them children?
Yeah, I think literally there's like, yeah, this is a good reason. Let's put it in. And then you're like, oh, well, no, maybe not. Russell, did you have anything that you wanted to bring up in that respect?
I think I mentioned before, probably, that I really was taken by Casey Mungiu's interpretation of Shinji, that I've talked about this, and sort of like the idea of, you know, seeing a classical work interpreted by different people. And I felt that way about a lot of the other voice actors, honestly. The smaller parts don't really have much to dig into. But honestly, Asuka's voice also won me over after a little bit. I know Tiffany Grant has a very specific voice, similar to Spike Spencer. You know, you have that same kind of, you know, nostalgia attached to it.
Yeah.
But honestly, the childlike, there's a lot more youth in the Netflix voicing of Asuka, and I have forgotten the name of the voice actress, and I feel bad for that right now. But you know, those lead characters, I mean, you know, Casey Shinji just goes for it. Like, all of those scenes, you know, with the sobbing and crying, is just like, wow, I bet you weren't able to speak for 2 days after recording this because you went for it.
Yeah.
You know, and Asuka's voice having a more youthful tone, I think, helps sell the idea better of her being someone who is frustrated by being a child and wanting to be an adult. So I really did enjoy those performances.
There's a lot I actually really feel like is interesting about those performances.
Yeah, I agree. I actually really liked a lot of the performances. It certainly wasn't one of my bigger problems.
Yeah,
with it.
Especially with Shinji, I feel like there's a lot in that performance that I enjoyed that I didn't expect to enjoy, actually. I mean, there's certain things I still love about the original dub, and certain things I like about those things, but that was taken in such a different way, and in some ways much better. Like, I don't feel like that character's whining as much as when I remember them, or at least rewatching that show. Because we, like Michelle, I was watching a lot of this on the original, like, you know, how...
We went from DVDs to Netflix back and forth. And you'd lose the nostalgia for those of us who've seen or even just watched anime when we were in the late 90s. But you gain a little bit of a different nuance in the performance.
And I think I want to give credit to the person who does Misato as well, because I feel like her performance is pretty much just like, as weird as this is going to sound, it's just the original, but like a different actor. And I feel like they nail that really weirdly, to the point I'm like, wow, this is really good. Like, you're just doing this performance again. I think Asuka's, oddly enough, the only one I had kind of a problem with. I did feel like all that youth stuff was there, and it was compelling, but she did grate on me after a while, unfortunately.
I really liked Gendo in this, the Netflix version. I don't know. He doesn't stand... His voice acting doesn't really stand out to me in... you know, in the original, right? He seems, for someone who's supposed to be this impending authority figure, he just never, the voice never got it across in the original. But I think in the Netflix version, he does. He feels like this kind of, you know, this overbearing father figure. And it's just, it's in that powerful voice performance. And that was a standout for me that I was surprised about.
Well, okay, now that we've talked about pretty much every aspect Evangelion that we could possibly talk about until their next podcast, when there's a million different other takes you could take, I have a question for everyone. What is your recommended follow-up for this series? What would you watch after this to, and it doesn't have to be in the same genre at all, it could be completely different, what would you recommend watching after this to help deal with the feels?
You mean a palate cleanser?
A palate cleanser, if you will, or actually just to keep driving that emotion going.
What is, I guess my question is, what was one of the things you liked most about the interpretation of Evangelion or from it? I'm going to say, if you really liked a lot of the religious aspects to it, I might recommend something like Fullmetal Alchemist, which uses a lot of Judeo-Christian religious symbols.
Brotherhood or the original?
Either works.
All right.
You know, that uses a lot of those Judeo-Christian religious symbolism, but in a little more subtle, a little more nuanced, and a little more accurate way. That's very enjoyable.
All right.
Bottled up in a compelling and fun story.
I think that's pretty good. All right. Anybody else got a recommendation ready to go?
Sure. Magus XLR.
Megas XLR.
I would say go for you know, living in Jersey with your giant robot car. You know, just
get your giant robots, but keep it fun.
Yeah.
So that you're focusing on the giant robot, but you know what? That is a good rec. That is a great recommendation. I like that. Michelle, do you have something?
We made a joke earlier in this podcast series in which Evangelion is basically just Yuri on Ice, but with robots. So,
I'm
just gonna say Yuri on Ice.
Oh yeah, because Yuri on Ice started as Ava fan fiction, or is touted as possibly starting as Ava fan fiction, and then just spouted off into this anime that's really, really good.
It's
superb.
Oh my!
The music is amazing.
The animation's incredible.
Okay, Russell, you are the mastermind behind all of this. We need a great recommendation from you.
Gonna keep laying that on me. There are a couple of things you could consider. I mean, if you want to go and track down the manga, they are being released in anthology formats. The ending is a lot more positive, actually, because it goes into that same thing of everyone in the world is absorbed into the sea of LCL. But it's stated more specifically that when Shinji decides to leave and resume individual living, he opens a door to everyone else who wants the same thing. And it actually ends with a final chapter of there's this new world. You know, there are these weird artifacts just standing out in the sea of these giant robots, and no one quite knows where they came from. But everyone's just busy going about their normal lives. You know, it's winter again, which it hasn't been since Second Impact, you know, destroyed the environment. And he runs into, you know, he runs into this girl on the subway, you know, with red hair, who's got a German accent, and he's all kind of confused, like, I feel like I know her, you know. So it's got that nice little, hey, let's put a bow on it ending.
I really like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's that to be had. If you want to go back through it, experience all the same traumas and disasters, but in the end, find out the idea that when Shinji decides life is worth the pain and so on, that really, that doesn't mean just, you know, lying on a beach, hating the fact that, you know, that the only other person with the strength to emerge was Asuka, but realizing that it's not just him, that, you know, there are so many more people in the world who would choose to live life rather than give up on, you know, on pain just to exist in bland nothing.
As worried as I am of rebuilds until they're done, I do kind of want to track down the manga and see what's going on there.
I'll lend them to you.
Oh, yes.
Ooh. I get them next.
Well, my recommendation, because I am at heart, I always want to complete the story myself. So this was a horrible experience. I grew up watching serialized fiction on television and having like no access to television, because the parents were like, hey, enough of that crap. You don't need to watch part three. It's the last part. So I always kind of made up my own endings to stories. I don't know why, but I've always done that. So I really enjoy filling in the blanks myself. So that's one of the reasons why I really love role-playing games. So I recommend, especially if you're frustrated with the way this happened, I recommend Tears of a Machine, an awesome role-playing game about feelings and robots. You can get it at robotclaw.info. It is, you could play it any way you want it. And you know what? I think we're going to do our next game night that.
I have my copy.
I want my completion there. I want to be able to control how this happens.
All right. You know what? If you guys play your cards right, I'll run you a session or two with the new and improved rules.
Ooh, exciting. Yeah. I'm very excited about this.
Ahead of the curve.
All right. If you enjoyed this podcast or have feels about it, please leave us a comment here or on social media. And like, follow, and subscribe to get more. We're probably going to be doing another Late to the Party soon. You want to know about it in advance so you can watch along with us, don't you? So hit that like button and follow us on the podcatcher of your choice. Thank you and good night.
Good night, everybody.
Yay! Hey,
see you next time for Gundam Wing, right?
Oh,
please.
Let's not say we did.
We can revisit better Gundams.
Nope.
G Gundam.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive Producer Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.